folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima McGinn, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Native Shark, which is an online platform for learning Japanese. And what Native Shark do is they make learning Japanese really, really simple. You log in, you click a button that says study now, and the platform then shows you exactly what you need to learn next based on your previous progress. Now, again, this is simple, but the way it's designed means that students who use Native Shark once a day for 4 to 5 months can complete the equivalent of over 2 years of university study. And this is not just them patting themselves on the back. Now that Native Shark's been in business for over a year, the results are in. So this is exactly what people are saying. Just looking at a couple of posts in their community forums, and the student community, by the way, is one of the best things about the platform. So one person's writing, most productive year I've had learning Japanese. And then another one says, I've started learning over a year ago with all of these other platforms, and what I learned there is only a fraction of what I've learned on Native Shark in just 3 months. And then yet another one goes, in my mind, my study timeline only started with Native Shark because that's when I really started learning consistently, and on and on. So yet the proof's in the pudding. It's definitely the best online course out there. And since you've heard about it here on the podcast, you also get an extra little bonus. If you sign up for their free trial using the URL nativeshark.com/NTI, and we'll link to it in this episode's show notes. So that's native without an E. So N-A-T-I-V shark, all one word, .com/NTI. You use that link to sign up and you'll get a double length free trial. So 2 weeks free instead of just the one. No need to put in your credit card or anything of that sort. You can just sign up, give it a shot. And chances are at the end of these 2 weeks, you'll already be far ahead of wherever you are with your Japanese at the moment, whether you're just starting out or you're already in knee deep. Give it a shot. nativeshark.com/NTI. Okay, so as usual, right before we get into today's episode, quick reminder about our awesome December business networking and board games, card games event at the Hotel Montan in Fukuoka. We've just finished shooting some video footage of the venue a couple of days ago, and my God, that lounge area and the private function rooms are stunning. I haven't been there for a couple of months, so I completely forgot how awesome that hotel is. And I'm now even more excited about getting together with all of you to talk some business, get to know each other, and of course, play some games. So we'll have that video edited and ready for you next week, hopefully, and you'll see exactly what I mean. But if you haven't read about the event itself yet, do hop over to our event page. We'll link to it as usual in this episode's show notes, but you can also find a link to it towards the middle of our homepage as well. That's at nippontradings.com. Okay, so for today's episode, this is a recording of the second event in a series of three hosted by Global Chamber, who are a community of CEOs, executives, and business leaders from all around the world. They've got members in over 500 cities globally and still growing fast. So in light of the new trade agreement between Australia, the UK, and Japan, Global Chamber put together a series of webinars, or Globinars as they call them. The first one was about the various different business cultures in each of those countries. The second, which I participated in, was a global trade update session. And that's the recording you're going to be watching or listening to today. And the third, which will take place on November 10th, is going to be an open Q&A session with all of the panelists from the first two sessions. Should be a really interesting one as well. You can register and join for free, and we'll link to the event page in this episode's show notes as well. Now, as far as this session that we're going to be playing for you now, that had four of us panelists, five including Kirsty Wilkinson, who was also co-moderator, each of us with our own connections to one or more of those three countries, each of us with our own field of expertise. Really interesting conversation about the current state of global trade, with a special focus on Japan, Australia, and the UK again. So really good chat. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening. Welcome to our members and guests of Global Chamber. We are delighted that you are here with us today to participate in part two of our three-part Globinar series focused on doing business with Australia, Japan, and the United Kingdom. For those who are new to Global Chamber, we are a global community of CEOs, executives, and business leaders focused on international trade and investment activities. We're not like traditional chambers of commerce. What sets us apart is we're in over 190 countries with 525 metros, just like the metro here in London. And our metros are run by business leaders who are steered by the global community to accelerate and enhance business activities for our members. In our last session, we focused on the importance of business culture, language, and the norms about doing business with each other. This was a great learning opportunity for us all when it comes down to how we do business better. So today's our second session in the series, and we'll be focusing on trade and business opportunities across the three regions. And it could never be timelier for us to be exploring these opportunities and also maybe the pitfalls as well, as the UK progresses to join the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a bit of a mouthful to say the least, but this is going to bring about some great business opportunities for a lot of our members around the world, with 11 countries already participating and over £111 billion worth of business being done in 2019 alone. It brings about a lot of opportunities to create new business channels. But it's also important to reflect why we're bringing these three nations together in this Globinar series. And that's really easy. Australia and Japan have a long-lasting and very strong strategic alliance and relationship, and also Australia and the United Kingdom, having shared cultural norms and many other things in terms of business and strategic alliances, it makes sense to bring us all together and to discuss the amazing business opportunities that are at hand as things evolve. And one of the other big topics we've been talking about is what is happening now for business now that COVID restrictions are lifting, you know, airports are opening, you know, we're able to move around a lot more fluidly. So I'm looking forward to today's conversation and bringing these opportunities to the forefront. But before we begin, I'd like to make some introductions. My name is Katie Keith, and I'm the Executive Director for the Global Chamber here in London, and I'm also the Head of Partnerships for Currency UK. I'm going to be moderating today's session, and I'm joined by my colleague, Kirsty Wilkinson, who is the Head of Asia Market Makers, and also our Executive Director for Global Chamber in Melbourne. Good morning and all good evening to you, Kirsty. How are you?
Thanks, Katie. Thank you very much for the introduction.
And before we go on to introduce our esteemed panelists, I'd just like to get a feel, Kirsty, because we've been having lots of conversations and we've been working together for the past few months to bring this series to life. And we've had a lot of topics of conversation. I know things are changing now in Australia. What's happening for you guys there at the moment in terms of business?
There's certainly a lot of excitement that Sydney and Melbourne have come out of lockdown. For a long time, we were in lockdown and there was very limited what we could do. People are getting really ready for the new year and excited about what that may bring.
Yeah, it's really exciting times as things start to open up. Having grown up in Sydney myself, I'm really looking forward to going home and seeing the family. I know it's not just about business, this community, it's about people as well. And a lot of us are living and working in locations around the world and we've been sort of stuck there for a period of time. So it's good to hear that things are starting to reopen. And guys, for people who have joined us for the session live today, we really appreciate that. For those who are joining us for catch up, you know, we're available to ask questions to after the fact. So please send them across to us. Kirsty's going to be sourcing any questions from the chat bar today, so please send them through. This is an interactive session. We'd love to hear from you. So without further ado, I'd like to get started, and I'd like to introduce our lineup of panelists who have joined us for today's conversation, and they're looking forward to sharing their insights and opportunities that are available and their experiences as well. So Richard, Head of Asia Pacific and Emerging Markets at International Investment Services in Gately, good morning to you, joining us from London. Morning. We've also got Sally Townsend, who's Commissioner of Trade, Tourism and Investment for the Government of South Australia, joining us. Sally, good morning. Good afternoon for you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Good afternoon, welcome. And Ziv Nakajima Magen, Partner and Executive Manager at Nippon Tradies International. It's lovely to meet you today, Ziv.
Thanks, Katie. Good afternoon.
Thank you. And last but not least, we have Christina Marino, Head of Travel and Hospitality to Sports, Travel and Hospitality Japan. Welcome, Christina.
Hi, thank you, Katie. Nice to be here.
Thank you. It's really great to have you all on today. And as I was saying before we started, this is a conversation. So I'm looking forward to sharing for you guys to share all of your insights and learnings and what's happening out there in the big wide world. And I'd like to start off with you, Sally. Could you please share a little bit, take a few minutes just to share a little bit more about yourself and the work you do at the moment?
Great. Thank you very much, Katie. So I'm a long-term Tokyo resident. I've been here for 20 years now, actually. 21 and a half, nearly 22. Wow, that's flown. But I'm from South Australia and I run the South Australia office here. So I'm in charge of Japan and Korea. And the office is actually only 2.5 years old. So we opened in 2019. And before that, I was in the wine industry for a long time. And that's where Kirsty and I were just talking before, where we first met when I gave a small seminar on the wine industry here in Japan. So that's my strong point, but we cover 9 different sectors here in my office. We're a lean team, literally 2 people, and a senior BDM in Korea as well, who I haven't been able to see in the flesh yet, but looking forward to flying over there as soon as I can. So that's my job, and I'm also the chair of the Australian New Zealand Chamber of Commerce here in Japan. I've been chair for 3 years now, I think, but involved in the chamber for a long time. And that's how I know Christina Marino, your other guest here this morning. We were both at the chamber. Oh, Christina, I think perhaps you left before I joined, but that's how we first met. So it's a small world over here.
It is a small world indeed, really, when you think about it. And it's really nice to hear. You've been in Japan for such a long time, Sally, and you've already, you know, a few people on the call from the relationships that you've built over time. You know, in the work that you're doing with businesses in Japan, what are you noticing in terms of, like, you know, what businesses are looking to do when they're diversifying into new markets at the moment? Are you noticing anything with them?
Yeah, I think, you know, from what's happened with China in particular, a lot of businesses are really looking at entering the Japan market, diversifying into Japan, or re-establishing their relationships here, or having another go. Perhaps they, you know, tried to enter the market a few years ago and they see that as another opportunity, for, you know, with a fresh start. But I think the fact that we opened in 2019 really worked well for South Australian businesses, because we're here and we're on the ground and we can work for them when they can't work for themselves. So it's been fortuitous in that sense. And we've been super busy just doing that kind of work, trying to keep relationships going, trying to keep things moving when people can't do that themselves. So timing-wise, it's worked out very well.
Oh, fantastic. And what do you know, are you seeing any trends for businesses? I know we were just touching on COVID and things reopening and trying to keep those relationships alive. Are you seeing any trends emerging now that things are changing?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of trends. And I think something we've seen and we've really kind of caught on with our South Australian producers is this trend in sustainability and functionality. So people have really had a long time to sit and think about how the world moves and, you know, what they're putting into their bodies, and really, I think, thinking about things for the first time in a long time. People have had chance to, you know, just to take stock. And we've seen a demand for certain things that, you know, people want high quality sustainable products. People want to see, they want transparency. They want to just not buy something quickly and dispose of it quickly. They really want to hold on to it. So we're seeing a lot of opportunities there for, you know, people looking to enter the market with these kind of products. And, you know, as I mentioned before, where companies perhaps had a go at the Japan market but weren't ready the first time, or perhaps the market wasn't ready for them the first time, it's, you know, I'm saying to these companies, I think they're ready for you now. Let's have another crack.
Yeah, let's have another go. I think that's time to revisit some of those past connections that maybe didn't go through for whatever reason, because we've had a lot of disruption, haven't we?
That's
right. A lot of time to reflect. We've all faced our own mortality in some sense, in terms of how we operate as humans and how we do business with one another. It's very interesting, Sally, and thank you for sharing that. I'm just noticing that Doug Brunke, our CEO and founder of Global Chamber, has got his hand up. So I'm just going to chime in for a minute and allow you to talk, Doug. You've got the stage.
You there, Doug?
You got your hand up, Doug.
Unmute yourself, Doug. Unmute, yeah.
Maybe you hit that by accident. Okay, we'll come back to you, Doug. Put your hand up again if you'd like to have a chat. But we'd like to move along now. And Richard, I'd love to learn a little bit more about you and the work that you're doing here in the UK to help businesses who are expanding globally, working in different markets. So over to you to share a bit more about yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Katie. So I've been living in the UK for 11 years. I moved over with one of the major Australian banks for what was meant to be a 2-year placement. Liked it more than I anticipated. Post that, I had a global role for a major international bank, and which really kind of took me to the Asia Pacific markets from using London as a base. And then obviously you can hear from my accents as well, originally from Australia. Like yourself, Katie, I'm looking forward to going and spending Christmas with the family, knock on wood if I can get there. So that's my personal experience. But International Investment Services, we are basically what we say on the name. We help businesses expand abroad and also scale. My particular area of focus is Asia Pacific, but we help businesses both ways. We help a lot of Australian businesses into the UK. We also help them then expand further, whether it's Europe or Americas, but we also help UK businesses the other way into Asia as well. In terms of trilateral trade and what we're seeing in the UK, I do think that the UK as a whole is positioning itself more towards the Pacific. I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think obviously I won't mention the B word, but I think that as a result of that, perhaps things weren't as enshrined as they were with the number one trading partner. They do realize that Europe is the number one trading partner. However, they are looking to diversify. Having said that, though, obviously you had that massive relationship with China and it still is there. And but like everyone and all the countries considered on this call, recently with them having a more aggressive foreign policy outlook, people are also considering other options and how they build those other options and diversify their trade from a few core markets, particularly when you consider how heavy everyone was invested in terms of getting goods from China, but also sending them to China as well. I think the whole coronavirus pandemic, particularly at the start of it, when all countries were struggling for PPE, really put it in focus of how much certain supply chains relied on one particular partner. You overlay on top of that, Japan was one of the first ones to roll over a free trade agreement with the UK. The Australian free trade agreement is one of the first major ones to be announced outside of a European rollover, that there is a particular will and want amongst the markets to do more together. We're seeing that at a government level, but it is flowing through to business as well. And if you look at foreign direct investment over the past 12 to 24 months, Australia has always punched above its weight in terms of being a net foreign direct investor in the UK, in terms of it being fourth globally. Japan has always kind of traditionally been strong, but as they were strengthening regional ties, I kind of dipped off, but that has picked up again. And I think last year, if you look at Department for International Trade projects, Japan was number one or number two. So we are definitely seeing those flows move forward. We are seeing a commitment amongst those partners to do more. That's flowing from the geopolitical space into the trade space. And also we're seeing a willingness from businesses to start trading again as well. One of the results of leaving the EU is it's also become a lot easier to get talent from the likes of Australia, Japan, because everyone's treated equally. So we also expect that once things open up again, that and also because people in Australia and New Zealand have been locked down for so long, you're also going to see a mass flow of talent next year and the taps really turn on and actually start to see a lot of British faces in Australia and a lot of Australian faces in the UK. But the good news is that it is flowing through to trade. We're running a program now for AusTrade where we're helping 12 Australian fintechs into the UK market. And we're also seeing a lot of it in terms of that knowledge transfer as well. We're having a lot of tech companies coming in from the region trying to establish themselves in the UK in recognition, particularly in the finance space, that UK is the fintech capital of the world. So all positives in that front. And I do think that you are, while not forgetting the importance of the next door neighbours in the UK as a whole is now starting to face a lot more to the Pacific, coupled with wanting to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. More trade and investment is happening between Australia and Japan. And I think you're going to see that trend continue in the near future as well.
Yeah, some really valuable insights there, Richard. Thank you for sharing those. And actually just reflecting on the journey that you took coming over to the UK from Australia is very similar to my coming to work for one of the big fours and then falling in love and staying in the country that you live in. And I'm sure we all share a very similar theme in terms of, you know, we're speaking a different language, but we're living in a different country. And so the talent movement that you mentioned is so critical in that knowledge sharing and growth of business internationally and building those cultural bridges and gaps. So there's this really underlying value in that. And I think that the talent and movement program that you're doing with AusTrade, if viewers want to know more about that, please reach out to Richard, because I think that's a very important project that you're working on. I know a little bit about it. And we're going to come back to you a bit more later, Richard, to talk a bit more about what are those opportunities and unpack that a bit more. But I'd now like to move across to Christina and learn a little bit more about the work that you're doing, a little bit about you, Christina, if you'd like to take a few moments to share.
Yeah, thanks, Katie. So I'm similar to both Richard and Sally. I originally came to a country for what was supposed to be a very short term. So I came to Japan 20 years ago as a research student for a two-year program on the Japanese scholarship program, and then ended up falling in love with Japan. Originally wanted to learn Japanese. That was my main objective for coming to Japan, and I decided to stay on and do a master's degree here. And then once I finished that, I temporarily went back to visit my mom, and then for some reason ended up getting married to a Japanese guy that brought me back to Japan. And I've been here for about 15 years now. So that's my personal story. But in terms of my work, I've worked for both Japanese and Australian companies, always with a strong focus on Australia-Japan relations and just strengthening the commercial relations. That's how Sally and I met. I used to be executive director of the ANZ-CCJ. So sadly, we weren't able to work together in that role, but obviously I'm a strong supporter of Sally and the work that she's doing at the ANZ-CCJ. So currently what I'm doing is I head the travel and hospitality business at Sports Travel and Hospitality, or STH, here in Japan. So what STH does is essentially create premium spectator experiences at major sporting events. So we originally came to Japan in 2017 to set up the office to essentially deliver the Rugby World Cup 2019 official hospitality program. And what's really interesting about STH and what we're doing in Japan is we're really creating a new industry. We're creating a new way of enjoying sports and creating a new way of businesses to connect with their VIP clients and for people to entertain using sport. And that naturally has a lot of opportunities for Australia and Japan to collaborate. You know, we've seen a lot of, you know, as a result of Rugby World Cup 2019 and the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, there's been a lot of conversation about the power of sports diplomacy and, you know, how you can use sport to actually connect countries and build your brand, your country brand. So we're seeing a lot of really interesting opportunities in that area. Obviously, Australia being a major sporting nation, there's a lot of opportunities for Australia to work with Japan collaboratively on major sporting events, I think.
Yeah, a lot of business, a lot of sport does bring us together. And in terms of leveraging off sporting events like that for businesses, where do you think where do you think the opportunities are at the moment for businesses, even in the UK and Australia, to leverage off, you know, some of the activities that are going on in Japan at the moment to reconnect those relationships? Like Sally was saying, you know, you're going back to try again. You know, what does that look like for business?
Yeah, so I think that thanks to the two major sporting events that Japan has just hosted, there's a natural growing interest amongst Japanese consumers in sport, not just participating in sport, but also spectating it. And we're seeing that, you know, we're also the official travel provider for Rugby World Cup 2023. And obviously Rugby World Cup 2019 has had a massive impact on, you know, the Japanese consumer love for rugby. So we're seeing that's the next tournament is in France. So we're seeing a lot more interest in that travel program and, you know, the opportunities that that will present for businesses that are capable at technology services around stadia, also wearable technology, anything that has to do with data insights. So all the stuff that currently I think Australia is also coming out with a lot of innovation around is very interesting at the moment, I think. And it's something that we can provide world-class services for major sporting events. But I think the key is also understanding exactly what your Japanese partner or customer wants and actually trying to find a complementary relationship. I think that sometimes that I think that is a key to understand what your customer wants and to actually be a consultant and try to understand before you actually try to impose something on the customer, if that makes sense. And I think I'm sure that Sally will probably have some examples of I think that is probably one of the things that will make or break a business relationship in Japan. And like, it's the attitude that, you know, a business comes with from the beginning, and, you know, just putting in the time and the effort actually goes a long way in Japan.
You've hit the nail on the head. And in our first part of the series, we really uncovered what that looks like. And you're right, it's building that relationship over a period of time. It doesn't just happen. And no doesn't always mean no, and yes doesn't always mean yes. So the language is completely different as well, which I'm sure you've experienced over the last 15 years that you've been living in Japan. And thank you very much, Christina, for sharing that. And I think there's lots of things emerging here and lots of things we can build on. And Ziv, I would love to call on you now to introduce yourself, share a little bit more about the work you're doing, a little bit more about yourself as well.
Sure, thanks. So I'm born and bred in Israel and moved to Australia, where I've lived for about a decade in my late 20s, and sort of married into Japan, like in Christina's case, a little bit after I moved to Australia, actually. So I've been coming and going to Japan for maybe about 20 years now, just under. And then about 10 years ago, we've decided to just take the plunge, started up our business a couple of years earlier. We're still running it from Australia, but then 2 years later, we've decided to move here on a more permanent basis. So just going on about 9 years now, living in Japan. And what we do is my wife and partner and myself, Chikako and I, we run a real estate advisory consultancy and portfolio management company. So and that's obviously topics that you've touched on the first seminar, and Christina just mentioned as well. But it's quite difficult in many cases to just bridge that cultural gap. So there are obviously, you know, many places in the world, there are a lot of, for example, real estate agents that would love to do business with foreigners, and the foreigners sort of have to pick the right ones that are safe and stable to work with. Here it's kind of the other way around. Almost everybody is safe and stable to work with, but it's really difficult to find people that will actually want to work with you as a foreigner. So we sort of realized we bought a couple of properties for our own personal investment portfolio, and then we realized there's quite a few people out there who could probably use just having a hand in going through the same motions that we did when we did our first few deals here. And that's pretty much what we've been doing ever since. So we help people research and conduct due diligence on, negotiate, purchase, and then manage your portfolio, whether it's investment properties or holiday homes or land for development or whatever they're into. And if and when they want to exit, we help them with sales as well.
Yeah, and I think that plays a really big role in everybody. Like, we've all moved around the world, and a big component of what we do and how we invest into our new life is around the real estate, even for businesses looking for premises and so forth. And I think, Ziv, what I'd like to know is, what are some key insights that you could share with international investors that about Japan and doing business there at the moment? Because I know you talk a lot about the culture aspect. What can you share with us now about doing business there?
Well, I'm just going to echo Christina in that regard as well. So obviously, it's important to listen and to recognize what the people that you're working with are actually like or interested in, or the way they do business anywhere in the world. In Japan, there's just more of that. So there are added layers. It's never transactional. It's always relationship focused. It always takes time to reach the decisions that would have been instant in other countries. And things are just not done the way you're used to in most countries, wherever you might be coming from. I mean, Japan's in Asia, but I think mentality-wise, they're maybe a bit more akin to Germany or Switzerland than they are to their Asian neighbors. They're very by the book and everything. And I mean, there's a proper way to do everything, and that goes into everything you do in Japan, and real estate is no different. If anything, it's maybe a bit more emphasized because it is an old school industry here.
Yeah, very, very important. And I think those insights are really important. And I think for me, when I moved to the UK and I started to settle after my 2-year spree of wanting to move home and then making it a home, having to go through all of that process of unlearning and then relearning is quite critical. And
now we're going to interrupt this broadcast. I always wanted to say that. We're going to interrupt this broadcast to give you a quick reminder that NTI is now partnered with Mita Securities Hospitality Property Fund. And they're offering their mind-blowingly gorgeous Machiya townhouses in Kyoto. So there's 4 of them, each about 100 years or older, lovingly restored and renovated to modern standards luxury. Stunning architecture and comfort, all the modern conveniences, including your scenic indoor or outdoor bath, spectacular dining and sitting rooms, disgustingly decadent Japanese or Western style bedrooms, high-speed Wi-Fi internet, kitchen, outdoor decks, Japanese gardens, the works. Now, each of these homes can comfortably host 2 or 3 families, including kids. So anywhere from 1 or 2 guests and all the way up to a dozen or so. And you can rent the entire house to yourself. So no other guests, it's all yours. Run around naked all day and night long, if that's your thing. Supreme Japanese style luxury accommodation. And since at the moment there are still no foreign tourists in Kyoto, these places are available for rent at ridiculously low prices. So we're talking as little as $430 for a whole week. That's right, luxury accommodation for an entire clan, 2 families or more, for as little as $400, $500, or $600 a week. Obviously, the longer the stay, the cheaper the rate is, but you can rent these for anywhere between 1 or 2 nights and up to a month or more. So perfect for a weekend getaway, extended holiday, workcation, family reunion, company retreat, or even as a gift to a valued client, whatever you might have in mind. And if you book these through our website, you're also going to get an added bonus of 1 or more 3,000 yen, so that's $30 QUO cards, QUO. Those are gift cards that you can use all around the country in convenience stores, restaurants, various stores, lifestyle shops, you name it. The number of cards you'll get depends on the length of the stay, but you'll always get at least one of these. So if you're in Japan, or even if you're out of Japan, but you think that you might be able to get in sometimes in the next year or two, and you've been thinking about spending some time in Kyoto, this is your chance to nab the best accommodation deal possible. So we'll link to the bookings page, which also has some amazing photo galleries for each of these properties on offer. Now, they all come with a fully equipped kitchen, but you can also choose to have your meals delivered to the property if that's your thing. The operator can arrange that for you at very reasonable prices. And if you can't see the show notes for any reason, just go to our website, nippontradings.com. That's NIPPON Tradings with an S, all one word, nippontradings.com/Kyoto-holiday-rentals. Or just go to nippontradings.com and you'll see the Kyoto Holiday Rentals option on the top right menu bar. Now, we are already taking bookings, so some of the properties may not be available on your dates. But Mida security guys are super accommodating, and they'll do their best to find you an available property for whenever it is you're planning your trip. Get on there, book your inquiry, and take that dream holiday in Kyoto that you've been fantasizing about while these phenomenal prices are still available. And now back to the podcast.
And I think now we're going to open up for a conversation, and it's been really lovely to learn a little bit more about you all. There's some real themes here around, you know, the exposure that we've had across multiple countries and the experience and the culture that we bring with us. And I wanted to get, all of you are doing work with global business leaders right now. You're helping people to achieve their goals when it comes to either moving their business into new markets or helping them to grow, helping them to understand markets. And Sally, you mentioned a little bit about working in the wine industry. I wonder if you could share a little bit more about what, you know, the next 12 to 18 months looks like for people trading across the countries, across Australia and Japan. I know that's your specialty. But, you know, what does it look and feel like to you over the next 12 to 18 months that you could share with others?
Sure. I think it's exciting for Australian wineries because a lot is going on. In Japan, not so much, but it will. I'm really optimistic about the future. I think, you know, Japan's hospitality economy or service economy will really bounce back from this in a big way. I mean, when you look at any lists of where people are looking to visit, you know, once they can move freely, Japan is usually at the top of the list for, you know, many nationalities. And that's where we'll see Australian wines in the hotels and restaurants being served to these people. So I'm really positive about the movement of Australian wine into Japan. The UK is seeing a lot, obviously. UK's always had this fantastic relationship with, you know, buying Australian wine. It's been long and loyal, and so has Japan. And I think what we need to do is, you know, Christina and Ziv both just talked about this now, is not imposing what we think is best to the Japanese consumers and markets. And this is what I'm seeing a lot with the wineries that want to diversify into Japan, for example, after they've been selling to China for so long. They think that same product is going to work in Japan when more often than not it's not. So this is where, I've fielded a lot of calls from South Australian wineries, for example, who've just, it's awful to see that these businesses have, you know, suddenly it was overnight, their exports pretty much went to zero for a lot of companies. And a lot of these wineries were solely exporting to China because it was relatively easy. I don't want to say easy, but much easier than Japan. Japan, as you know, as Ziv was just talking about, it's not transactional. It's all about relationships. So you can't just come over here and plop in your wine and have someone buy it at a really great price. It's, you know, it takes a lot of time. It takes market visits. It takes someone to come over here and traipse around the restaurants with their importer. So, you know, this is where winemakers will have to look at what they're proposing and if that works with what consumers want, what the market is saying. We can't come to market here with 14% Shiraz that's in a bottle with red and gold on the label, because that's obviously been made for another market. So yes. I think there's a lot of positivity here. We just have to it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take 12 to 18 months, but we can lay the groundwork now. We can listen to the market, see what the market wants, what consumers want, and get ready for the service industry boom.
And Sally, what you're saying, and it's not just about the wine industry, this is about all industries and how we go about doing business. And I think I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, Richard, because, you know, I'd like to know what you think the next 12 to 18 months looks like here in the UK for inbound business expanding inbound, because I know you guys do a lot of market research and help to support in that space.
Yeah, so I'd like to pick up on a few things that Sally said. I think that applies to across industries. So even exporters that the importance of being in market and kind of immersing yourself and kind of going internationally. We advise people don't do it half-hearted. You know, you need to be able to commit the resources to your internationalization. And if you don't have the resources, then don't do it. Perhaps double down on your home market until you can get to that point. With Japan, as opposed to Japan compared to the UK, coming from Australia, there is actually a recognition that, wow, the way of doing business here is very, very different. Actually, I probably should try and take the time to understand it. It is going to take me a while. One of the biggest mistakes we see from Australians coming into the UK is to think that they can do it remotely or to think it's the same as Australia. You know, they're vastly different markets. You are kind of positioned between kind of Europe and then in a still workable same day time zone to the Americas as well. So you do get global competition. Whereas in Australia, you know, it can be you're a big fish in a small pond, but when you get to the UK, you are actually in quite a big pond. And then there's there can also be a naivety that, you know, because you're unique in Australia or you've got a unique value proposition that automatically it's the same in the UK without actually testing it. And I'll give an example. You know, as part of our program, we also include a bit of executive training from people from London School of Economics, and they're talking about value propositions and trying to address competitions. And this one startup that we're dealing with is like, oh, we're completely unique, there's no competitors. And it's like, okay, well, who actually plays in your space? And they said, these guys, but then their offering's nowhere near as good as us. And the response was, okay, so have they gone out of business? And it's like, no. Are they looking like they're going out of business anytime soon? It's like, no. So actually you do have competition. And perhaps your unique value proposition, as you see unique, might not be so unique to the market or might not be what's valued in this market. So I think there are kind of some general rules there. People did get comfortable doing business with Zoom, but people still prefer doing it in person. And particularly as Australia opens up as well, business was still happening via Zoom and Teams, but that's going to be less of an excuse moving forward next year, given that Australia has opened the borders. So there's a generic advice here in the next 12 to 18 months, don't spread yourself too thin, choose a market, but also commit to it and get there as well.
Yeah, some really strong points coming out there actually, Richard, thank you. So mistakes are being made remotely and it ties into that new norm of working as well. And what does our new normal look like? How are we engaging at the football match? How are we engaging doing a business deal? Are we gonna fly to Japan? Are we gonna fly to Australia or the UK? And I'd like to call on you, Christina, to add your thoughts into this conversation, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's perfect because now we're talking about travel and, you know, we've just been, we're still a very new company in Japan and we've just started really our travel business right before COVID hit. And obviously there's no denying that the travel industry globally is in a very difficult situation due to the fact that inbound and outbound travel basically has stalled. And of course, we've got several travel restrictions that have been put in place due to COVID-19. But I think that the outlook for Japan-Australia travel business opportunities in 2022-23 for us looks quite positive. And there is a sense of optimism in general that the recovery will be quite strong and steady once the restrictions have been lifted. And as I think Sally mentioned earlier, I think Japan has traditionally been a major source of inbound tourism for Australia. And that relative importance of Japan for Australia is likely to increase even more as we emerge from COVID-19 and as we move into the recovery and growth phases. So the opportunity is probably for Japanese travelers. As we know, they're high value travelers. That essentially means that the average Japanese traveler spends two or three times more than you know, other people who travel overseas. So there are certainly business opportunities for travel operators like SDH Japan, for example, to create packages that are going to be attractive for Japanese customers who want to travel to Australia, but also for Australian businesses that are looking to work with Japan-based companies to actually offer, you know, those value-added experiences. Or other things that we're seeing is, as we've, I think we've mentioned as well, like sustainability is now becoming quite a key. And also within the tourism industry is offering the opportunity for people to give back or to feel that there's purpose behind their expenditure. So that's one of the trends that's emerging at the moment. But again, it's putting the time and effort to understand what the Japanese business and consumers actually want to get out of their experience. And that comes from working closely with the Japanese-based partners. In terms of events, again, 2021 was a very tough year for major events. As we all know, the Olympics and other major sporting events around the world were either cancelled or held without spectators, sometimes without international spectators. So obviously the restrictions around gatherings has really affected the hospitality industry. But again, we're already starting to see the easing of restrictions around that as well, which will support the travel industry. So in general, I think there's optimism in the market at the moment that things will get better in 2022. But again, it's going to take about 12 to 18 months, I think.
Thank you, Christina. I think we are on a road to recovery. And I think even here in the UK, you know, the hospitality industry is repairing itself. And I think that having a purpose around where you want to do business, going back to Richard's point, choose your market and do it well, because we now need to explain why we're investing in travel and resources and moving from one place to another, not only to our bottom line, but to our consumers as well. You know, where are we spending our money and how is that sustainable in our company? So all of these factors are really key to making decisions on what happens over the next 12 to 18 months. So really rich information coming here. And Kirsty, I noticed you popped your hand up. Would you like to add?
Yes, I would like to add a few things. I think what Richard mentioned about one market at a time is just so true. I think you tend to spread yourself too thin if you try and deal with too much at once. And also to Sally's point earlier about wineries, I actually was working with a winery last year who has done very well in China. I was interested in Japan, but they've just put the feelers out there. They're still, you know, waiting to see what happens, I think. But and we tried to educate them on that the way business is done in Japan is very different to China. And I actually was working with another Japanese company as well with this client, but they clearly weren't ready. But I think they'll probably go back when they're actually, you know, ready to actually take the plunge. And I think they, you know, they hadn't realised how much kind of money needs to be, is involved, and that, you know, things don't happen overnight. And that's what we just reinforced all the time, that it's about building relationships and you know, building it over time. It doesn't just happen overnight. I've also, earlier this year, I became a Edgar Golf registered player, which is a international golf tour for people with a disability. And that's the number of member countries is actually growing. And there's actually been a very well-known Japanese golfer who also coaches mainly now. And I've actually been talking to Paul Sheehan, who owns Elite Japan. They actually run golf tours around Japan, and they're actually been adding new golf courses to their ones that they offer. And we were looking at ways that we can actually work together. I was also contacted by Arigato Food Tours in Japan, and I'm actually going to be talking to them about the ways that we can actually work together. I'm actually going to be doing an interview with them probably in early December, which is really exciting. And I think also the Paralympics and the Olympics has really got people very excited about, you know, being able to go back to Japan, hopefully, you know, in the next year or so. People, it's always, as Sally was saying, I think before, that Japan is also, or might have been Christina, on the top of the top of their list in terms of places to travel to. It's always been one of mine, and I'm dying to get back to Japan. It's been 4 years and four long years, I think. But and I think, you know, people are starting to think what else you know, they can do. So thanks.
Yeah. No, really, really. Thank you for sharing that, Kirsty, because it just comes back down to that people element and how we've all been impacted by this change in our lives. And the Olympics does bring about a lot of amazing opportunities for the city that hosts. And, you know, how unfortunate that we've had a pandemic throughout the Olympics, but and it's really changed the way we do things. And I wanted to hand over to you, Ziv, because we're still going to be going through, over the next 12 to 18 months, my opinion is we're going to be having a mix of being able to do things remotely still, but also trying to accelerate and move things along, build those relationships in a way that we can. How is it possible for people to continue to invest into Japan in property remotely?
To be frank, for us, it's been remote from day one. So I guess because a lot of the work that we do is serving different clients in different time zones. And a lot of the properties that we help people purchase, just because of the 2.5 decades of deflation that Japan's had before the 2012 and so forth recovery, properties are very affordable. So people are not going to hop on a plane to buy a 20, 30, 40,000 US dollar condo unit, especially if it's got a tenant in there. So according to Japanese tenancy laws, they can't even inspect the property when it's being tenanted. So we've been working remotely from day one. And I guess for us, the pandemic, I mean, it separates a bit between investment property buyers and holiday home buyers. And the investors, not to sound tone deaf, because a lot of people, like Sally was saying, did suddenly lose a lot of their income or go out of business. But for investors, this has been a very opportune time. So prices in central Tokyo, central Osaka, and Nagoya especially have been a lot softer. Even if they were not listed for a lesser price, they were definitely more negotiable. So our clients have been buying a lot in 2020 and even more so in 2021 to date. So from an investment perspective, things haven't changed much. If anything, when the market will recover, it maybe will become a bit more subdued. Holiday homemakers, though, are waiting. Some of them, the braver ones, are buying sight unseen or remote viewings sort of properties that we view for them. But a lot of them, when you're buying a holiday home, you actually want to inspect it in person. You want to walk through it. You want to look at the neighborhood or the area that you're going to be purchasing in. So they have been purchasing to some extent, but a lot of them are waiting on the sideline. So I'm guessing, if anything, the next year and a half, as soon as the movement is going to be a bit less restricted, we're probably going to be seeing a lot of holiday home owners coming in and purchasing.
But there's a lot of opportunity at the moment. It's a good time to invest. And I'm hearing that you can do it remotely. So there's nothing really holding people back. And I think as people are starting to move around a bit more, and there'll be lots of families relocating, lots of people moving around for job role changes that have been hanging on for those few years. I know quite a few colleagues that have been waiting to go to the US for work. And so all of those things are starting to happen again, which is quite important. And I do get a lot of questions about, you know, what about the family? What about the culture? What about settling in? And I think that's really key. Thank you very much. Some really key insights there. And I think we've touched quite a bit on, you know, committing time, understanding the nature of the beast and how long it's going to take the investment and getting it right. You know, what are some of the pitfalls? And I'm going to throw out to anyone who'd like to answer. What are some of the things that businesses need to think about in this market at the moment over the next sort of 2 years?
I think it's being patient. Really being patient, because it's going to take time and it's not going to happen overnight.
Thanks, Kirsty.
For me, one thing I think is making sure that you're keeping up with the ever-changing trends and the market. I think it's still going to be quite volatile, and it's still going to require for us to be always well-informed, well-prepared, and very agile to actually take advantage of the opportunities that come out through the various changes. I mean, travel is changing. Like, we literally, like, travel restrictions, you can't keep up with what's happening in every country right now. But for people who are in that industry, it's very important for us to understand, and, you know, the consumer sentiment.
And where can people access, where can businesses access these trends and information? Do you have any sort of tips or hints around what businesses can do, some practical elements of checking in on these trends? Where can they find out?
I think joining events like this is always very useful, because you get really good insights from various perspectives. But also for us, obviously, the, you know, government publications, research, there's a lot of research happening right now. So, you know, just the usual official stats. It sounds quite boring, but it is actually reliable information. And just talking to customers, I think, talking to the people who are going to buy your products is always the most important thing, in my view.
Yeah, fantastic.
More than ever, and we talked a little bit about this before we went online, Katie, is Japan can be a little bit insular when crisis hits. They tend to just focus inwards. You know, like when the pandemic hit, for example, they suddenly didn't even allow foreigners who are living in Japan to enter the country again. So I think that will take a little bit more time to taper off, I think. So it's always important, and people who want to start a branch office in Japan or sell a product to Japan often hear that you're probably a lot better off establishing a local corporate presence, even if it's a little sales office, and hiring native Japanese to be your mouthpiece here in Japan. And I think that's going to be a trend that's probably going to be a bit more emphasized in the next year and a half, because we have not a generation, but a lot of people who have been graduating and are, you know, have entered positions in various companies that might have not even been exposed to foreigners over the last two years, and maybe for the next 1 or 2 years. And it's really going to be those relationships with local Japanese entities or a local Japanese presence in Japan is probably going to be something that's even more crucial at the moment.
Really good point. So having key contacts on the ground, or even being able to be on the ground, is quite important still, which is quite an important thing. And I think we're discussing that. And as these new business channels open up, how are we going to do that effectively is the big question. And I'd love to hear from Sally and Richard as well on this, in terms of what you're seeing, because I know you are working with businesses to help them with that as they come into the market. Richard, would you like to go first?
Yeah, sure. So going back to your point about where does one find this kind of information, if you are seriously considering about exporting or investing in an overseas market, use your local trade bodies. So that could be at a kind of federal/national level. So for example, if you're in Australia, Austrade. But if you're looking at the other way around, use their trade body as well. So if you're looking at an Australian business looking to enter the UK market, you can leverage both Austrade, but the Department for International Trade as well. Also, if you're in a particular industry, look at the local industry bodies as well. They will have the latest in terms of regulations, news, updates. It'll also give you a good grounding to reach out to complementary businesses or potentially partners in the country as well. So they're always good sources. And also industry trade magazines, and, you know, all else fails, Google and LinkedIn are always very good sources of information as well. I think what you are starting to see is Europe is now open to the UK. The US has started to open up as well. So if I'm a, you know, Asia Pac business, I need to be wary that these people are going to start coming to the UK. So don't necessarily do it remotely. You also raised another interesting point as well, and I was musing about it with some colleagues in similar industries about what the nature of our business travel in future is going to be. And I think you are right. I think it's going to be more selective and more focus on the value. And I think that will be with also your visits or the period of time you spend. So for example, if you're an Australian business looking to establish in the UK and you're not quite at the point, or you are setting up that sales office, rather than flying in 1 week, you know, every 3 months over that first year, you might actually just come and invest 4 to 6 weeks and kind of get it all done, rather than kind of go in and out as well. And I think that's going to be another trend as we look to business travel. I think will start happening again. But I think those trips will be a lot more thought out in terms of how to extract the most value. Is there a way to do it where I possibly reduce the need to go back within that half or within that quarter, whereas before it would be, you know, I might, however ridiculous it is, crossing time zones, might fly in for a day or two, then fly back just for that one critical meeting. It will be, you know, would consider that one or Zoom, or can I build out my program so I don't have to go back in 3 months as well. Having said that though, things are starting to open up, and although whether it's Japan or Australia, as if you mentioned it for Japan, but Australia's done a very, very similar thing. For those of us Aussies who've tried to get back, we know that. But the rest of the world isn't. Credit to New South Wales and Victoria, who've said, actually, we operate in a global marketplace. We need to get things open again and start trading. And I think you're seeing a wave of people going back to see family, but a lot of Australian citizens and permanent residents who are doubling up with work trips. And that's essentially what I intend on doing this December as well.
I think it's also put people off staying in Australia, and I'm one of them. I'm seriously thinking about what I'm going to do next year. I'm seriously thinking about moving back to the UK to do my master's. And also spending some time in Japan. I've just felt that during this whole pandemic, my career literally been on hold. There's a lot of people like that and thinking what they're going to do going forward.
Yeah, it's a big impact. And I think, the going back to your point, Richard, it's sort of the nature of the business and why we're going and, you know, making these big decisions within our business and our own lives as well. I'm just mindful, we've got 7 minutes left of our conversation today. And Sally, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that topic. And then I'd like to just do a recap on some of the thoughts and emerging themes that have come out of today's session.
Thanks, Katie. Yeah, just back on the information, as I said at the beginning, I'm one of those people that South Australian businesses can reach out to know more about the Japan market. Austrade is there, and most Australian states have state offices in other countries. And, you know, the Chamber of Commerce here has been terrific, I think, in, the disbursement of information and keeping people informed. And we've seen a huge rise in overseas members, because we are on the ground and we can give that information, and a lot of information is not available in English. So for people to log on and try and Google, right? Try and Google, good luck with that. So, you know, if you're a person looking at establishing a presence in market over here, for example, you've got a product and you try and find if a similar product is available in Japan, you will be bombarded with information in another language that's, you know, flashing lights, very messy. I'm thinking about Rakuten at the moment, for example, messy, hard to understand, hard to kind of navigate websites, and, you know, it's not easy. And I don't want, looking at that again, I don't want people to get discouraged. That's a pitfall, I think, Katie, in that people think it's too hard, it's going to take too long, it's too hard, I'll wait. And that's what, you know, representatives, people, companies, consultants, you know, Kirsty, Richard, Ziv, you know, that's what we're doing. We're assisting people kind of navigate overseas markets. And it's, Japan's fantastic. It really is. And it's, you know, a great place to put your product in if you've got the right product. But there can be so many, you know, barriers. But, you know, there are grants out there. The Australian government is giving businesses money. Use them, see what's available and have a go.
Yeah, thanks, Sally. And I think just to say thank you to you all for your really valuable insights, tips, hints, resources. There's been a lot that's come out today. And I know that for the viewers watching from home and those who are attending today, I'm really grateful for everything you've shared. And just to share a few things that have come up for me. And I think I'm going to start with the real positive. Trade and investment is happening right now. Don't delay. There are people out there to support you. We've got experts on here today. We've got experts in our Global Chamber community. There are lots of other bodies that are helping people as well. Lots of grants and funding available. We want to make trade as easy as possible by coming together and building communities just like this to make it possible. But I think most importantly, forward planning is key. Sticking for the long game and having a strategy in place that can help accelerate that forward, but in a meaningful way. So being sustainable, being thoughtful, engaging with the right people, building relationships, understanding culture and barriers and values that are going to drive that relationship forward, because you're investing a lot into this process. And so you need to get it right. And I think technology came up a little bit there. And I think this is a discussion for another day. How can we use technology to start building these relationships and start moving things along? And to Christina's point, how can we engage in a meaningful social way where we can come together at sporting events? We can start to meet in a way that's going to bring us together as a community. And then also, Ziv, thank you for your insights on what's happening in investment into Japan in property. That was really, really quite useful. And so thank you very much, all of you. Those insights are very key to driving us forward. And for our viewers, we will connect you with all of our panelists at our third part of our Globinar series, which will be an open forum. It's not going to be a panel discussion like today. It's going to be what we call a meetup, a cross-metro meetup with the Global Chamber. It allows people to talk to the panelists, any person, talk about their business, explore opportunities. We're going to have breakout rooms, and we're going to talk about then making the business happen. So we'd like to do a little business along the way, as well as learn about what we can do. So for everybody on the call, thank you very much. We'll see you on the 10th of November for our next meetup. And we'll be sharing this recording with our audience a bit later as well.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Katie. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, thank you, Katie.
Enjoy the rest of your day, evening. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so that was event number 2 of Global Chamber's Globinal series on trilateral trade. Really informative, really knowledgeable panelists. I trust you found some value in it. And if you have, again, be sure to sign up for the third and last panel, which will be more interactive. So basically open floor again for audience Q&A. Should be really interesting as well. And again, we'll link to the event registration page in this episode show notes. And once again, before we go, 10 to 12 December at the Montan Hakata Hotel, which you'll soon see in the video, but you can already check out the photos of the venue, the speakers, the food, etc. Our business networking and board games, card games, strategy games event. Really hope to see you with us. If you haven't booked yet, well, what the hell are you waiting for? Link in the show notes as usual. Hurry up and secure your spot. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.